Hello, this is Deborah Anderson, the Black Woman Animator, come back to you with another video. And in this video, I have Rohitash Rao. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Can you introduce yourself a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So I've been, it's funny, I got into animation completely, I think, by default, because I started out in advertising, was an art director, writing ads, and then decided instead of writing ads, I wanted to start to direct ads, started directing commercials and music videos. And, you know, because I came from a world of writing commercials, most of it was live action, so I was doing live action commercials. And I obviously had a bunch of short films I wanted to make, and short films, especially when I started, which was like 95, I was shooting on film, and film is not cheap, and making short films, especially on film, is not cheap. So I couldn't keep making all the short films I wanted to make. So I realized the only way I can keep making the short films I wanted was to animate them, because I didn't have to worry about crews and actors and sets and, you know, camera gear and locations. I could just literally go into my garage and make a film. And so I self-taught myself animation just because I had to keep making these shorts. And so I got a book, specifically the book on, I think, Pigeon Run. It was one of the Aardman films, and they had like a making of book of that film.
Oh, Chicken Run?
Thank you. Chicken Run. And I bought that making of book, and I read it like, you know, 100 times. And this is like, again, like 90s. And I just kept reading it and reading it and reading it and following all the steps of how to make claymation dolls and how to build like miniature sets and how to ideally animate. And that was it. I was off and running. And I said, okay, I'm going to keep doing this. And I keep, the more you do it, the more I think you just learn. And I would say a cross blend between stop motion, hand-drawn, and live action. And I do some CG. I don't actually do the CG, but I direct it. So I still do all of it as a director. And the stop motion stuff for depends on the project and depends on the timeline. I will actually animate it, or I'll obviously bring in crew to do it. So now I think I'm like a hybrid, I guess, filmmaker of all the formats, and I've learned a lot from stop motion that actually helped now on the other side, help me influence on how I direct live action.
Nice.
Understood, you know, how I, if I was to construct a set, even though it's live action, how would I construct it as opposed to just seeing what's available at like a location. I think I tend to now look at it from the point of view, if I could build it any way I want, how would I build it? Despite the fact that I can't on a giant set. So yeah, and then here I am. This is my art studio. This is actually, I'm also a painter and a, I don't know. Yeah, so I build, I do everything in this room. I animate in here. I paint in here. I cry in here. I write in here. Yeah.
Multifaceted, multi-purpose.
Four walls. If these walls could talk, yeah.
Right. So you were born in Hyderabad, India, and you grew up in Rancho Cucamonga, California. How was it growing up? What is your origin story?
Yeah, so actually, I made a pilot about this actually too. So my parents, my dad got a job in California when I was about two. He was trained to be a glassblower, so he was a craftsman, learned in Germany, and then ended up getting a job in California. They moved to originally West Covina, California, which is where I originally grew up. And then eventually my parents settled in this town called Rancho Cucamonga. For those of you who don't know where that is, it's basically like, it's kind of shy of Mount Baldy, kind of southwest of Big Bear, in the San Bernardino Valley, part of Southern California, about 2 hours, you know, from LA. And it was a really, it was like a new community. They were building like this, all these new homes and kind of, you know, cul-de-sacs that were being built. The whole new like town was being constructed when we moved there. So we were the first, any kid who grew up in that area, especially in high school, you were the first kid to ever live there, which meant like you could like walk to the next street and be like, hey, you're brand new, I'm brand new, let's hang out. And over time, like became like this really weird, like it was like we were like settlers in a brand new and you know we were, you know, everything, we were the first one, a high school I went to was the first high school that ever existed. So when you graffitied on the wall in that high school, you were the first person ever to do that. Like no one had ever done it before you. No one had No one had ever written on the chalkboard before you. So we grew up in a town where it was like a brand new planet that we discovered. It was a magical place. So I ended up writing a TV show called Rancho Cucamonga. And the kind of
or
the
Fox.
You know, no one's from Cucamonga. We're all immigrants. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it was symbolic of my parents being immigrants moving to America. So mm-hmm. it was a cross-culture thing. Like, I grew up in a very Indian household. Everything was very colorful, which is kind of why I think all my work is so colorful, because I just grew up with color all around me. And then I'd go outside into America, and it was like bland and kind of gray, beige, and that was what Cucamonga was like. And there was kind of this contrast, you know, of these two worlds. I lived in this colorful world, but I had to exist in a colorful world. And it was like this constant thing about identity. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, like the Cucamonga was like symbolic of the immigrant kind of mentality of how I think people adapted. So I wrote this thing, and eventually we got right involved. We ended up getting Lorne Michaels involved from Saturday Night Live, who ended up producing it. We actually got Mark Hamill and Russell Peters to star in it. We made a 15-minute.
Russell Peters!
We have an animated pilot. We made it for Fox. Fox, I guess, officially owned it for a while. We finally got the rights back. We never got it picked up. It never got picked up, and now we're trying to see if we can bring it back to the world. So nice. That's my whole life, in a way, in this pilot, because it literally is about my journey and about my family and the comedy. You know Russell Peters. Russell Peters, when he got involved, he and I would talk about our dads, because our dads, Indian dads, are just, they're just funny. Like, they don't mm-hmm. And we started writing this thing about my dad and how he was trying to adapt to American culture. Like, my dad mm-hmm. white and blue Ford Pinto in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Dad, why buy a red, white, and blue Ford Pinto? Well, I want American. I'm like, I don't know that's gonna work. But so that's what my dad did. And yeah. So it was all these jokes that eventually people like, you know, Russell and other writers started to jump on, and we started to write really authentic, for the most part. I think, you know, just insights on our parents. And, you know, I think Russell and I specifically talked about our dads for a lot. So it was very much, it's very much about my family and my upbringing, and it's very personal, and it's also very, relatable to, I think, a lot of people. Whether you were Indian or not, I think you just had like that kind of immigrant type of, you know, upbringing. I think you can relate to how your parents are so trying so hard to adapt mm-hmm. to American culture. And you as a kid are like, you're not doing it right.
You don't
fly out on Christmas. I'm just saying, Dad, that's not the thing. It's just, it's not a, you know, Independence Day kind of holiday. But he just doesn't. You know, they just didn't know. And it was mm-hmm. a lot of comedy in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I came across Russell Peters in college back in like maybe 2005. Like, I did an alternative spring break, and one of my friends, like, we were just kind of, we did community service for spring break. And so we were just like chilling, and he like showed us Russell Peters, and it's like, yes. So what are some of your best childhood memories?
Well, one of my favorite ones is my dad constantly tried to, and this is actually something I wrote into the pilot, because it was a way to relate to my father in a way that I really didn't understand as a kid. My dad became the coach of my baseball team, you know, when I was like 8, 9, the little league, you know, team that I was on. And my dad didn't know baseball. He didn't understand how baseball worked. He knew cricket, and mm-hmm. cricket worked like baseball. So he would teach us how to swing a bat like a golf club. That's how you swing a cricket bat, right? He would teach us how to catch with our bare hands, because that's how you play cricket. So, you know, we're doing this as a team, and my fellow, you know, teammates look at me and be like, does your dad get how the sport is played? We're not supposed to be catching with our bare hands. You know, we're not supposed to be swinging a bat like this. And I go, Dad, what are you doing? This is not baseball. He's like, Oh, right. Okay. And he, like, in his really, you know, kind of innocent way, was like, I just wanted, you know, teach you how to be better and play the game. And And I, you know, as a kid, you're like, you're embarrassing me, Dad. This is so embarrassing. You don't even know how to play the game that you're trying to coach. Dad's response is like, I just want to, I don't care about the game. And I'm like, wow. As a kid, you're like, that's not the important
right.
part. We got to win the game. My dad cares about the game. I want to hang out with you. So it took me a long time over my life to really realize the perspectives of both those, you know, me and my dad. It's obviously very beautiful. That's why he did it. That said, we actually got pretty good, and we actually were able to catch balls with our bare hands, which no other team could. So that was kind of nice. And my thing, which is actually, well, is my dad had a huge. He used Burt Reynolds as his American symbol of machoism, and Burt Reynolds, you know, back in the was the guy from, you know, like Smoking the Bandit and all these shows and movies. And that was, my dad looked at as like, he's the American I want to be, you know? So my dad, I don't know if he grew a mustache because of him, but he had a mustache and, you know, in Halloween wore a cowboy hat and kind of had a Burt Reynolds outfit on. His mind, he was Burt Reynolds, and he would walk around. We're like, Dad, no one's gonna. And you look like an Indian wearing a cowboy hat, not, you know, a Burt Reynolds version of you. So that was always an ongoing joke in the family, was like, he was, you know, in his mind, he was Burt Reynolds. And at one point, I think he unbuttoned his shirt like down to here. We're like, no, put that up. Just put that. So there was a lot of, I mean, my childhood was rich with all these things that I think, and for him, it was just innocent. He wasn't trying to be funny. He wasn't trying to be anything than just, you know, him. And, over the course of my life, I could look back and I'm like, that's some funny stuff. So thankfully there's a lot of material to draw from. Still is.
What is your favorite custom or tradition from your culture? And then what is your favorite custom or tradition that your family had growing up?
Well, it's funny. We're in India just now. Like, I just got back again like a week ago. I don't think I realized how many things we were doing at home that were actually legit Indian cultural things. The funniest thing, and I don't really understand this one completely, but if you were to sneeze right before you're about to walk out the front door, you'd have to stop. Like, you can't leave the house. You have to literally like sit down and let like the sneeze, if you will, like, there's a term for it, but it has to like, the energy has to like kind of rebalance. It's the weirdest thing. Like, you'd be walking out the front door late for a, you know, school, a meeting, and like your mom will sneeze. She's like, hold on. We got to wait. We're like, we got to go. We're going to miss the bus, or we're going to go. She's like, we got to wait. And you just sit there and you wait, like, I don't know, 30 seconds until
everything recalibrates.
I don't know. I don't understand. I still don't know what the term is or exactly what's going on, but that's such a weird Indian thing that I've had a lot of friends, like, you know, my Indian friends, I'll make fun of and relate to. That's something. This is something that I've seen a lot. We didn't do it a lot. We hardly did it as a kid in our house, but I've seen it done. I think it's called Rangoli. And basically it's, you bless the day. So, and this is partly, I think, when I started seeing it as a kid, I saw this being done in India, and it's basically, it's like chalk art. You basically like you fill a handful of like, say, like colored powder or even like just like, you know, any kind of white chalky powder. And you basically make a pattern, very specific pattern on the front step of your house every single morning to kind of bless the day. It's a way to kind of like begin the day and to, you know, the spirit of, you know, all things. And you kind of like use that to kind of like guide your day. It's kind of like doing morning meditation. It's a way to kind of begin the day with such a beautiful note. It's being grateful. It's being, you know, open to all, whatever the day is going to bring you. And that's something that happened every day in the house we're staying at in India, which is my family's house, my dad's sister's house, actually. And anyway, where it was happening every morning, and it was so beautiful to watch that because, you know, I don't think, I mean, I've never done that in America. I don't like start my day like the art to bless the morning in, on my front step. But I think, yeah, the culture in India is something that I think I appreciate more and more, like the more I'm witnessing it, and I see some of the traditions my mom still, you know, adheres to, but it's beautiful and it's very spiritual.
What would you say your journey in art and animation was during your childhood?
There was a specific time in the 90s that was there was a festival specifically called the Spike and Mike film festival. The Spike and there was a, I think eventually became the Spike and Mike Sick and Twisted Film Festival. And this is where people like Mike Judge, who created Beavis and Butthead, started. And this was something that I don't know why, but I also grew up MTV used to have, you know, I mean, music videos, obviously, but also they had like kind of they had an animated block called Liquid Television that was around, I think, around the early 90s. And these kind of things, the Spike and Mike Film Festival, the Liquid Television, these were places. I mean, this is way before the internet, so this is the only place you could access this kind of stuff. But this was a cross of everything I loved in one place. It was cartoons, but sick and twisted, dark. You know, very bizarre comedy, David Lynchian kind of cartoons, and I didn't even know that was a thing. Like, it never, I didn't know. I love comics, like, I love, you know, the Sunday comics, I love graphic novels, but I don't think I haven't really appreciated it done in animation until those two things. And I saw that, and I've always, I loved comedy as a kid, obviously. I mean, my dad's stories alone became a gateway for me to write comedy. And then I saw these films at festivals and on Liquid Television, and I'm like, that is something I want to do. And even now, even the commercials that I do as a director, I try to do weird. I'm for the most part, I think I try to do. I try to get. I get jobs to do weird commercials, like they're bizarre comedies. And I've written art directing ads, writing ads for Little Caesars, Staples. You know, which is again trying to be funny and, you know, doing absurd, ideally kind of, you know, quirky comedy. So that was always kind of my shtick. And then animation came into my life, and I'm like, whoa, I can draw it, make great voiceovers, like, or myself and my friends can do funny voiceovers, and then I can write the most bizarre comedy, and I can pull it off animation. I don't worry about like some special effects or whatever I have to get to make that joke work. I can just draw it or build it out of clay. So it became anything is possible. It was the only genre that I could ever think of that could combine every single thing I love into one. You know, all the versions of comedy and drawing and art and movement and music and sound. And so yeah, animation's like probably my favorite thing to do. I wish I could do it faster. That's my, I think, my only wish about animation, which bizarrely kind of goes back to my India thing, because the one thing that Indian culture has really taught me and a lot of just my life is this sense of calm and meditation. And what I had to learn for many, it took me a long time to figure this out, but animation is pure meditation. I mean, you're spending so much time moving a figure a fraction of an inch, and that's 1/24th of a second of movement. And you do that 24 times or whatever, depending on how much time you want your animation to take. But you know, you're doing like a fraction of them. You could, you know, I would, on average, I think it t takes me about an hour to do 1 second of animation. And if you break that down, if you say that, it sounds like, I don't know, it sounds almost like too much. But if you really concentrate on that one frame, every single thing you're doing is worried about this one frame. Every piece of set, every piece of art direction, every piece of doll, you know, construction for one frame. And you click the camera, and you're like, all right, let's do it again. Do another frame. And it's such a calming version of art making that I think that's partly, I think, what keeps me bringing, what keeps me going back to it. And I love the meditation part of it, but it is obviously a very slow, slow, slow art. So I think over time, I really started to appreciate it more and more. And started to appreciate all the films I've ever loved more and more, because there's no shortcut, you know, there's no fast way to animate. I don't think you pick animation. I think it picks you, because I think you really gotta, you know, want to. I don't think anyone's forced to make animation. It's too much work.
Mm-hmm. Something you said made me think, like, from your childhood and, you know, journey through life, like, India has become a big player in, like, being overseas studios for animation. Like, what are your thoughts on that? Did you, I don't know, because, you know, pre-internet and all that stuff, but did you see that happen from America, or, like, do you have any thoughts on it?
I mean, I just know in my friend circle, I know specifically in a very big tech world. I mean, you know, there's obviously headquarters of every major company, Google, Apple, whatever there. And I do think has had a partial say probably in how much, like, you know, production is being made in India. But I do think so much of Indian culture comes from, there's so much mythology and so much storytelling. I mean, you know, the Mahabharata and all these books that have been around forever, and all the stories of the Indian gods. And I mean, how do you not go into animation? Like, there's so much stuff to talk about. It's like, you know, like Roman mythology, Greek mythology. There's so many things that have, these stories. I mean, you can walk, I mean, even in my house I grew up in, my parents have all these, you know, Indian Hindu gods on the wall. And as a, I'm like, what's that person's thing? Like, what? Why do they have 18 arms? What's that? He's an elephant head? What's that? You know, and they're like these giant, like, you know, cartoon / superhero characters. And as a kid, you can't help but just imagine them, you know, moving and flying and, you know, jumping around. And so I think it's just the drawings of these things that you would see as a kid from, you know, old books and, you know, even the films that were made by the time I was coming, you know, into the world, into the world of animation. It's just rich. It's just rich with stories and culture. So, you know, Of course, India is going to be in that place. Mm-hmm. Just how I was never surprised when I finally started getting into Miyazaki films. I mean, all the Japanese films, especially in the 80s, where they were like huge in America. Like, my, you know, as a kid, I would watch a lot of these Japanese cartoons that were playing, you know, on whatever, like, you know, non-traditional channels as a kid on TV, mm-hmm. blown by how Japanese animation was far superior from what I was watching from, like, Hanna-Barbera and, you know, Warner Brothers at the time. And then eventually I started seeing Indian cartoons, and I'm like, yep, of course, they're going to, like, do their slant, and it's, you know, it's so rich. I don't know. At some point, I would love to do a cross blend of all of this. I don't know what my version. I would love to do, like, an American Indian inspired by Miyazaki type, you know, future style of animation.
Nice. I'm glad I thought to ask that question, because I just realized, like, last week or so, I came across, I don't know if it was a TikTok or something, where it was actually talking about, you know, the statues in Indian culture and the multi-armed, you know, sculptures, and how they're actually supposed to be read, and it's actually a story, and to think of it as whether it's motion or a story. And I was like, oh, okay. And because the person in the video was like, oh, I never thought about it like that. You kind of just look at it and like, oh, that's a multi-armed like person or something like that. But it's actually a story in each way the arm is and stuff like that. So that was cool to find out.
Yeah. In fact, in my pilot, I actually had a character. So the elephant god, his name is Ganesh. And Ganesh, the story is that I think I'm butchering this, but somebody had a kid, and they cut off the kid's head on accident, and to fix the head, they got an elephant and put the head on the kid's body, and it became this elephant. So in my pilot, I actually wrote a character where Ganesh lives in the house with the family. In Ratchakukamanga, Ganesh is actually the god who lives with them. And he's basically the elephant god, and who is all-knowing, he's a god. But in public, he reverts to being a dog. So he's basically a family dog, like put him on a leash. He's got an elephant looking face, but he's a dog, and he walks around and he acts stupid. He acts like a dog, but at home he turns back to the god. The leash stands up upright, and Fox is like, "You can't do that. You can't make fun of Ganesh. We're gonna get in so much trouble if you do that." And I didn't. I just thought it was a funny joke that we'd have Ganesh in the story somehow. But I get it. You can't make fun of gods in any kind of religion especially not now. But I had to study this to be able to write it. Like, I had to know who Ganesh was, the whole character. And I started to realize, oh my God, this is rich. And that was just one character, which is Ganesh. And I just did a whole deep dive of the time into the whole story. So yeah, you're right. There is multiple layers. I mean, I jokingly said one time, it'd be cool if they did a Hindu gods version of Star Wars, because you could do TV spinoffs, you could do you can do a number of miniseries, you can do movies, but again, it's gods. So being as obviously making having fun with Vader and Luke in the same way. But yeah, I'm sure somebody somewhere out there is trying to find a way to probably use all the inspiration of all the gods, but not call them gods.
Yeah. Your father was a craftsman. Your mom was a scientist. Did that have any bearing on how you grew up or what you had to do or anything?
I was heavily pushed into science as a kid because it was very cliche Indian. It was either science or science, engineering or medicine. Those are the three options. Because that's what they knew was going to be something employable. That's why. And I understand that. I thought it as a kid, but I get, their thinking behind it. And if you look at, even again, being in India just now, I was looking around the house and there's so much art in our family, people who were painting as a kid, that at some point they stopped and they went into, again, engineering or science or medicine. And I'm like, why'd you stop? And they go, because that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to go into it. And I tried. I actually was a chemistry major my first year of college. I was drawing my entire life. I always drew stuff. I always made stuff. To make little Super 8 films, really tiny things where I would film. I would get like little toy boats. We had a swimming pool growing up. We would get little toy boats, get firecrackers, film the boat going down a lake, and then it blows up, and that will be a short film. And so I was making films, I guess, and drawing forever. But it was a hobby, and it was, as my mom put it, it's a hobby. It's not a jobby. And so it was never something I could do as a career. So my mom, being an aerospace engineer when she was, in her heyday, working in engineering, she thought, you might want to go into math. You may want to be good at something in this engineering world. You seem to like science. You seem to like, all whatever. You seem to really, I like microscopes for some reason as a kid. So chemistry seemed to be a good place to go. I did one semester of chemistry at San Jose State University. Got into an honors chemistry program, was getting a D, and my TA pulled me aside one day and he goes, "You are the worst student we've ever had. You don't want to be here. I can tell. Why are you here?" And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know. My mom, I don't know. I can't." He said, "Get out. Seriously, get out. I'm doing you a favor. Get out of here." And then I did another semester, try to fight my way through it, and obviously just was not into it. And then thankfully, because I tried, my mom was listening to me. She goes, "Okay, what do you want to do? Because this is not working." I go, "Can we go to an art school? Can we find an art school, please? Just art school. Find me any art school." And then school called Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, California, which is not very far from, you know, a couple hours from where I grew up. And, you know, it's a private college. You have to apply with a portfolio. And I didn't have a portfolio. I didn't know what a portfolio was. So I go to the school and the school was like, well, what do you want to do? And I go, I don't know. What do you got? I don't even know what the options are. She's like, well, you can do whatever you want. You have like, you know, filmmaking, animation, graphic design, photography. And I'm like, all of it. I want to do all of it. Can I do all of it? I want to do everything you just said. She's like, well, go into advertising because you'll be able to get a little bit of filmmaking, a little piece of graphic design, a little piece of whatever, photography, illustration. So I'm like, yeah, that's it. I'm in. She goes, well, go build a portfolio. And I'm like, okay, what's that? She's like, show us stuff. Like, you know, specifically how you can write an ad or your illustration skills or whatever. So went to a junior college, which for every Indian, that's like the worst thing you could ever do, especially for an Indian mom. She was so like, you're going to a junior college? I'm like, well, I have to. I got to build a portfolio. I don't know where else to do it. So she was like, don't tell anybody. And I'm like, so I went to a junior college and I took every art class they had, you know, I think I was allowed 7 classes. I took like 8 or whatever. I took 7. I took every art class I could possibly get under, you know, for my schedule. And I went from like being like a C, you know, student at San Jose State to being like an A+ student at this art junior college because I loved it. Like you could tell, like everyone could tell. I was, you know, doing more work than I think I needed to do because I just wanted to like almost catch up with my life. I'm like, I'm 17, whatever. And I'm like, I gotta do everything I can to kind of earn my 17, 18 year old version of myself because I hadn't done that seriously that much until now. And suddenly I got into Art Center and then I was full, you know, I was just full steam ahead. And it was like life changing. I literally went from like, I have no reason to do anything that I really love to, I don't want to sleep. I don't want to eat. I don't want to do anything else, but just make all these things. And that's when I think my parents were like, okay, like we see you now. You're serious. You're putting in the time, you're putting in the effort. I wasn't like I was supposed to. And then it became, you know, I don't know if you know this, but I teach now. I'm a professor now at UT Austin. And this is part of what I teach my students. I'm like, you don't have to know. You know, this is kind of the beauty of like being a creative. You don't have to know. You can just keep creating and almost like reinvent yourself by just making a version of yourself, like animation versus live action versus painting. So that was the beauty of going to Art Center. It was like, they even told me then, like, you don't have to just be an art director. Just you're a creative. You know how to execute. That's everything. Now you figure out what you want to do with that. So that became, you know, for me, the greatest thing ever. For my parents, it became like, well, what's your job now? Because you were an art director. What are you? And then I, what do you know? And, you know, what do you know? And, you know, I'm like, doesn't matter. I'm just me. I'm just a creative. I'm just don't worry about my business card. Never made sense to me that you would have a one note like description of your job anyway. Like, well, who cares about a business card? That, you know, all these like supposed rules that I was brought up with never made sense. And again, what my dad learned to be a craftsman my mom was basically a mathematician in her engineering. If you think about what animation is both those things. The craftedness of building a set, building a miniature, which is what glass blowing was to my dad, and the mathematical skills of how to basically break it down in time to move a doll, to make it go from A to B. You've got so many steps, which is just math, so many, you know, frames per, you know, kind of set, per, you know, I guess per movement to get it from whatever timeline. And even the way you're going to rack focus or you're going to move the camera, it's all math. It's like, I've got to get from here to B, from A to B. I've only got so many movements. I'm going to move it, you know, 10% increments from here to here. I'm going to do a rack focus from here to here. So it's every like quarter inch along the way. It's just math. So in a weird way, it worked to my benefit that that's how I kind of came into the world, was like this math, like mathematical brain with my dad's kind of, I guess, love of trade skills, which is his version of glass blowing and craft. Even painting, I would say, is a combination of both, because you're breaking down, I would say, a painting into a grid of how you're making shapes and the craft of how you move the brush and the paint and the kind of paint. That's just, you know, a learned thing of how you control your hand. So I think a lot of it ended up being exactly what they did, just in a way no one ever thought possible.
Yeah, like that's actually because I was going to become an engineer before I found animation, and I took a class at a community college in high school. And so that's what drew me to 3D modeling, was like I was good at math and good at art. And then I was watching a video on YouTube yesterday, and I'm like, and the guy's like, you know, digital sculpting is more free, but traditional modeling is kind of, you know, stunted. I'm like, oh. So what actually drew me to 3D modeling is what other artists hate. Like, I love the pushing and pulling of points, but other people are like, oh, I love ZBrush. And I'm like, I'm struggling in ZBrush because it's like about discovery. And I'm like, ah, give me like steps. So, yeah. I read a book recently. It's called Art Matters by Neil Gaiman. And it's like a quick read. Like, I did it on audiobook. It was like 50 minutes. And so it was like a quick read. And something he said was, when you start out in the arts, you have no idea what you're doing. This is great. People who know what they are doing know the rules and know what is possible and impossible. You do not, and you should not. The rules on what is possible and impossible in the arts were made by people who had not tested the bounds of the possible by going beyond them. And you can. If you don't know it's impossible, it's easier to do. And because nobody's done it before, they haven't made up rules stopping anyone from doing that again yet. So,
yeah. Great. I had an epiphany a couple years ago, or maybe even I think in class one day, and I love not knowing, and I say that because if I embrace not knowing, it doesn't become intimidating. Like if I don't know how to make this painting, for a long time I'm like, I'm not going to make the painting. I don't know how to make it, and that would stop me from even trying.
Yeah.
But looked at it from the point of view of like, well, let's have fun not knowing, and let's see what happens, and let's see where this takes us. And that approach took away all the anxiety, took away all the fear, and it made it like, I'm going to just walk down this road and see where it takes me. And at the end of the road, make a decision if I'm going to go left or right. I'm not going to make a decision now, because if I make a decision now, I might not walk down the road. And also what I like about that mentality of not knowing is that you're not in charge. The painting is in charge, or the film, different for animation, because you've got, it's more planned out, but for a painting, it's a lot more fun. If I go like, I'm going to open up a can of blue and a pint of, you know, yellow, and let's just see what happens. I'm going to use this brush, and I'm going to put the canvas on this easel with this light coming in, and I'm going to get that shadow to kick it off, and let's just go. And you start, and then the painting starts to talk to you. And I will say, you only know when a painting is done is when it shuts up, because when it stops talking to you, do you know it has no longer has a thing to say, which means the whole time conversation going. It begins with you starting the conversation, and then the painting, and you are back and forth. And it'll tell you, can I put a little bit of over here? Can you make this right? Can you make this better? Can you make this better? And then you go back and forth, and you go back and forth, and you go. And then it becomes, you're not in control. You're literally having this fun journey together. It changed how I create, and it's become a lot more fun. And I roll up my sleeves a lot more these days, because I love not knowing. I don't have to know. I don't need to have the answer before I begin.
I feel like my journey in adulthood is realizing how apropos the phrase ignorance is bliss is, because sometimes if you knew how hard it was at the end of it, you wouldn't do it. So the ignorance is key to you going on the journey.
I also found this thing I read years ago, and it didn't make sense to me until probably recently-ish, which was this game I play with myself, with my brain, which is reward myself for every little thing. So like, I'm like, okay, I'm going to build a miniature set. I'm going to build a set today. I'm going to start with a tree. I'm going to build a miniature tree. And when I'm done with that tree, when I'm done with this tree, I'm going to go get myself a smoothie. Because that's my celebration of my accomplishment. My again, it's like a reward for that treat. So great. build this tree, get a smoothie. Awesome. Come back. Okay, what else? Let's build a little river. Let's build a river. Great, let's build a river. Then what? Let's get lunch. Let's go get a taco. Yeah, a taco for a river. Awesome. And you keep doing that, and suddenly, it again, you're just giving yourself that little bit of a, like it's kind of like a pat on the back for every little thing you do. And it just keeps you moving forward and moving forward and moving forward. And you're so proud of yourself, and which makes you keep wanting to do it because you're giving yourself, you know, this feeling of accomplishment for any little thing. It could be like, let's write a paragraph for our, you know, the book we're writing today. Write a paragraph. If we get to a page, let's get a beer. You know, we deserve a beer after a page. And it's just that. And it try to like strip away all that anxiety and all that intimidation and all that, like, you know, imposter syndrome or all that stuff that I think, I'm sure we've all dealt with at some point, and try to make it as easy for yourself as possible and as fun for yourself as possible. That's the other part, is like, if I was just doing it for the end result, like waiting for someone to be like, hey, I liked your art, that may or may not ever come. You may never ever get that, and you may never ever get into that film festival or get that thing, you know sold, or the painting may never even see you know people like it in any way. So if that's all you're doing it for, I think, you know, I realize over time that could be huge disappointment and heartbreaking. Whereas if you're doing it because you love the journey, then you're going to keep doing it forever because you love the journey, because you've made the journey fun for yourself.
Peace be the journey. Cool Runnings.
I love that movie.
Yeah. Towards the beginning of your career, somebody said that you were like too weird for live action. Like, what were you doing?
My very first commercial was this, again, I just wanted to do, so it was weird. I worked on Little Caesars. And while I was doing a commercial, they had one of my friends had just did another commercial with a chimpanzee. They had a chimpanzee in the commercial. And I'm like, hey, how'd you get that chimpanzee? He's like, oh, well, there's a chimpanzee wrangler in LA that we hired, who basically he brings them on set, and, you know, he obviously, they're trained, you know, animals, and they can do whatever you want. And I'm like, I want to use a chimpanzee. He's like, for what? I'm like, I don't know. I'll write a commercial around that. So there was this guy I randomly met through my friends at the ad agency who were using this animal wrangler. And so I'm gonna write a commercial where it's gonna be I was really into, I grew up in LA, really into skateboarding and all that stuff. So I'm like, I'm gonna do a commercial for skateboarding Airwalk shoes for whatever reason. I worked on Airwalk as a freelancer, and I wrote a weird commercial that never got sold. So I rewrote it for this, only I added the chimpanzee. So it was going to be these two kids skateboarding down a street, and they got mud on their shoe. And they're like, how do we get mud off of our shoes? And they go, well, let's go see the monkey. And then they skateboard towards a chimpanzee's armchair in the middle of like a cul-de-sac, whatever. And by shooting the film backwards, we basically have the mud fly off the shoe back into the monkey's cup as if he threw it on them. And that's how they solve their shoes to be cleaned, because the monkey saved their dirty shoes. And that was I shot that as a commercial. I don't know what drugs I was on. I don't know why that idea came to me, but it show off my skills as a storyteller. The monkey obviously made it. It just kind of elevated the comedy. I got some really funny action in there with, like, you know, just these kids skateboarding down a street. I found a great location outside of LAX called the Dunes, which is an area outside of the airport, which is a piece of land that you can rent pretty kind of cheap, especially if you're, you know, doing what I was doing, which was, you know, kind of just like a simple, I needed a place where it was safe to bring an animal that wasn't going to have a lot of people that you had to deal with. That was my first commercial. I made that one commercial, shot it on 35 millimeter. I got a Panavision camera through my DP friend, and high end, looked amazing. I did, it cost like thousands of dollars to make it just because I wanted to show off all my skills as a filmmaker. And somehow we got on ABC's funniest commercials, right? I think I had joined a company and the company had sent in some stuff to the ABC and whatever we got on, and people thought it was a real commercial. It looked real, it looked high-end, and it makes sense. Like, you know, it was a weird, you know, sneakers, high school kind of, you know, spot. So so all my friends would see it and they'd be like, we can't hire you. That's the weirdest thing. Like, who's, no one does work like that. We can't use that for, and I kept doing that for my spec reel. And my entire portfolio, people would be like, we like it, but we don't have anything like that for you. Like, that's not something that, you know, your stuff is just too weird. And where to, you know, to see your strengths in anything that we're working on. And it was partly because of that. People were like, if you go into animation though, you'll have a lot more freedom because people will allow you to be as weird as. And it was a great eye opener, I guess. What I'm happy about is that I didn't change into what they wanted me to be. You know, I really wanted to stay in my weirdness and my bizarre storytelling realm and not just adapt to traditional American, you know, especially version of what I think it's probably weirder now than I probably give it credit for. But at that time, I don't think I was going to get a lot of really weird commercials on that level. But in animation, suddenly doors opened a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a funny story that your family always tells about you that is like either embarrassing or?
God, so many. I think the ongoing thing that I think my family was dealing with when I was growing up was the fact that I was trying so hard to keep making the stuff I wanted to make, but not, but still play by the rules of the family. Like, my parents were very, you know, had very specific wanted me to do. I don't know if this was exactly the way my dad meant it, but he really pushed my brother and I, especially me, because I'm older, to learn a sport and learn an instrument. Like, those were kind of mandates, because he wanted obviously us to be as well rounded as possible. So education was important. Go to school, do all that, but also do other stuff, all the other stuff outside of normal school. So at one point I was in Little League. I played the accordion. So I was in accordion school, Little League. I think I was in Cub Scouts, and then I was obviously doing school and I loved it, but your schedule was just packed. You're just like constantly full with stuff. And I think there may have even been like a swimming or something in there as well. And at one point, my dad just sees me and I'm overworked and just completely tired and, you know, just trying my best to keep up. And he goes, you know, you're doing too much. I know I pushed you to do this. I know I wanted you to do all these things, but I think you're overdoing it. I think you have to quit one of these things. And I'm like, okay, I'll quit school. He's like, no, that's not one of the things you can quit. You can't quit school. You got to quit with it. And I'm like, I don't want to quit. I love Cub Scouts. I love, you know, baseball. I love, you know, how that happened. But I love all these things. I don't want to quit. He's like, but you can't do it all. And I'm like, I think I can. I'm going to try to do it all. And it was almost me proving to them that I could, because I had such a, you know, each one had its own world and friends and, you know, culture. And I loved all of it for not just the thing, but also the world that it brought me. Like, again, you know, the people I was hanging out with in each of those groups. So I didn't want to stop them. I didn't want to give them up. And obviously at school, I was probably, you know, I'm sure at one point I was volunteering to do like, for the school plays. Like, I would art direct, like, you know, all the playbills or whatever they're called. So it was even more stuff on campus that I was probably doing as well. But that was, to this day, I think I'm still juggling a number of things. So I think that was something that I think my family looked at, like, you're going to crash and burn. Like, you're just way too much. And it was selfish because it was, I'm like, I don't, I mean, what else, what I, like, what else am I going to do? Am I going to watch TV more with all of you? Like, on a fun and all, but there are things to do. Like, I want to do so many other things. And it's constantly been, even now, like, I was with my family, just before I came back to Austin, they're in San Antonio, and I was with my parents just before we got back from India. And they're like, why don't we, like, have, dinner, we go out. And I'm like, we could, but, like, I literally got to get back to work. Like, I have, now school starts, and I got to get my syllabus up, and I have to get all my lessons, my classes, worked out for all my lectures up. And again, I love hanging out with you, but I got, now things to do. And so, in some ways, I think my dad looks back and he's like, what have I done? I was told him to go out and do all these, both my parents, don't stay home and watch TV, go out and explore the world and go, do things, learn an instrument, learn a sport. And then they're now, I'm never home. Like, they're like, damn, what have we done? Because we, they were the ones who obviously pushed us out the door in the first place. And once you discover it, once you're out the door, I think you, if you enjoy it, you're forever out the door. And that's, I think, something that I think, we talk about every now and again, that it's, they made me who I am, and now they're like, shit.
I feel like according to your personality, it makes total sense that you play the accordion because it's like multiple instruments in one kind of.
Well, I was originally a failed drummer because I took my, again, my dad just had learned an instrument. He didn't care what instrument it was. So I went to the music school and they go, what do you want? And I'm like, well, that looks fun, the drums. And I'm 8 and I'm playing the drums and the teacher is like, your son has no rhythm. I don't think he's, yeah. So they go, pick another instrument. So I picked the piano, but my hands, I'm 8 years old, so my hands are small. So like, to make scales was, it wasn't as easy for me to make scales. So they go, why don't you give him another instrument till he grows older, because his hands will grow and he can come back and play piano. And they go, maybe the accordion is an answer because it's part percussion and part piano, so it'll give him both but in a different way. And I'm pretty sure this is true, but I don't exactly remember. There was a girl in my accordion class who I had a huge crush on. Again, I'm 9 years old, and they were, she was 12 or something, and she was the best accordion player in the school. And I'm like, oh my God, I want to be as good as her, and she's so cool. And I she's the reason I stayed. And I'm like, I'm gonna keep doing this. I love. So even when I was getting older and I could, I guess, transfer over to piano, I stuck with it. I still have it over here.
Nice. Can you talk about your art show, Rahit, Records?
Yeah, so this is actually funny. These are all fake covers for some of my fake bands. And this art is about because I have a love of music and design and typography. This is a band called Your Daily Dignities. So all this came about because I grew up, again, like, with a sense of graphic design and a sense, I grew up in the 80s. And so, MTV. So the we were buying vinyl, like, on every, I think I was buying an album every Friday. I think the joke, my parents, I think, remember, is that they would give me $2 a day for lunch or something, and I would not eat lunch. I would spend the $10 at the end of the week on a record, and that was my version of, like, how much I loved vinyl. I would just go buy a record every Friday. And as I got into my art world, I'm like, well, the idea of creating an album cover just seems like something I've always wanted to do, and I never, obviously made a career out of it. But I made a short film years ago called Battle of the Album Covers, where I took 75 famous album covers and had them all fight each other. And it was done for a charity event in New York, and that became a big hit on YouTube, and it got me actually working in the music video world. I got my first gig doing a Poison video after that. So the idea, and I, okay, part of it, why it came out, was because when the short film was getting a lot of attention on YouTube, record labels called us and wanted to sue us because we had no rights to any of the album covers. Like I'm taking Pink Floyd and Zeppelin, all these famous albums, and the labels are like, you can't just take those albums, make whatever you want out of it. These are copyright albums, you know. And they said, if you would have just made up your own albums, this would have been fine. You could have made up your own album covers for whatever, and it would have been a parody. Totally okay, but you took real album covers, and that's the issue. In the end, nobody sued us. They were actually very impressed by the short film. Even some of the bands, I think, told the label, leave them alone. It's fine. They didn't do anything, you know, really bad. It was, they just had a good time with our album. So the idea of making a fake album, which was in their words, was something just hit me. I'm like, a fake record? What if I just made a whole fake record store? So I started doing a series. I just made up five fake album covers and showed it to my friends. And they go, that's funny, do more. And I made five more. And then I kept telling this to my friend. I was living in Venice Beach at the time. And I told my Venice Beach community, and a good friend, Delia, turned me on to, she was the curator of the Google in-house, like Google had in their main office has a lobby, and they had art shows in their lobby in Venice Beach. And she told the curator at Google that there's a guy who's making up a fake record store. And they go, you put up your fake record store in our lobby. And I'm like, sure. How many albums is that going to need to fill your lobby? And we did the math, and just to line them up one by one by one, needs about 140 albums to be able to fill their lobby. And I'm like, I have 20 albums. And they go, well, you've got like about a month. Can you do it? I can. And then 120 albums or whatever in a month. And I just took every photo I had off my phone or actual film prints, and I just adhered them onto album covers, blank album covers, and wrote. I had to just make all the albums, and it was like a marathon to get to the finish line. And then the best part was at the end, they go, why don't you put on a concert? And I'm like, yes. And so I called friends who actually sound house in LA called Jingle Punks, and I go, can you guys make up some songs by the fake bands and play live? And they did, and we had a concert, and it was a record store, and then it was now the bands are going to play live in the Google auditorium for a private concert. And that was the beginning of Rohit Records. And then that got out, and then a record store in downtown LA, Pop Obscure Records, had heard about it through a gallery they go, why don't you put your fake record store in the back of our real record store? So it'll be like all real legit album covers on shelves, and it'll be now fake albums. So it'll be like Zeppelin, Pink Floyd, and Wolf Dick fake bands. So we just started making up, I try to match their shelving to look like a continuation of their store. But obviously, if you at a certain point, hopefully, if you didn't know, you figured out these were all made up. And they had a stage, and they gave us concerts, and we could put on shows. I think I was there for like 3 months. I had my installation in their record store for like about 3 months. And about every other week, we'd have, bands, like just friends, including me. And we just made up songs by the album cover bands and played live, and we just had shows, and it was an ongoing art exhibit. And I've done I think a dozen shows now. Like I went to a Nashville music conference and actually met the owner of Tal Records at the conference, because I was not only setting up my record display at the conference. And then I gave a little talk about my love of album covers, how as a kid, I grew up in LA. My first real record store was Tal Records growing up in Southern California. So I would go to Tal Records, and Tal Records to me was like an art gallery, because the art of album covers was always something I really appreciated. So I always say, that was my first art gallery, was Tal Records. And the guy from Tal Records is in the audience. He's like, I want to say thank you. And I'm like, whoa, you're here. Yeah, it's been like a really amazing journey and fun, because it's just everything I love. It's art, it's music, it's design, it's photography, it's illustration. It's everything I can, an album cover is so, it's anything works, everything works. So I can draw anything, make anything. And for a while, it was all my failed art found a way onto the album covers because anything being out. So paintings that just never had, you know, that much life outside of the painting. I just thought, well, here's a good place to have it, you know, exist. So it has like kind of a new, and it became a way to recycle art in a way. And I found that same with musicians, because I would tell musicians this. I'm like, hey, I want you to make up songs for, you know, these album covers. And people would be like, you know, I have this song that never went anywhere, but let me just make it a fake song, you know, by or real song by your fake band. And they recycled their music. So in a way, like, it became a place for people just to kind of, you know, just create and be free with creating and, you know, recycle even stuff that never seemed to have or needed a new life, because this is the perfect place to put it, because it's a comedy show. Like, you, no one comes in expecting it, you know, you to be the next Bob Dylan. You know, all they want is something fun. So everything, because you're just there to have fun. So, you know, the bar is so low. Like, anybody can show up with a guitar and a ukulele and a kazoo and play. Like, that's awesome. Of course, that's all we want. We just want fun, a fun place to have, you know, hear music and look at art. And that's what this, the whole art show has been.
Nice. I was in a Women in Animation mentorship circle. It was kind of like a DEI thing. And so each week we went through, you know, disenfranchised groups and how they're affected by in animation and stuff like that. And so I came across you in the Problem with Apu documentary that we watched in class. And so how did you get the opportunity to be in that documentary?
So Hari, the guy who made the documentary, was the person I originally called to be in my Cucamonga pilot. I had met him through a mutual friend. And when I was writing that thing, I went to Hari and I go, will you be the voice of the father character? And he was like, I don't think this is a good idea. He said, I think, you know, there's a responsibility that we have as Indians to portray our culture. And he goes, in a nice way, he goes, I think, Ro, you might be making fun of us more than you realize. Your dad has an accent. I know he kind of, I mean, I exaggerated it, but my dad does have it, not to the degree of how much we pushed it for comedy's sake for our pilot. That was Russell, who obviously, you know, did it, but who did the voice. But Hari was your first person. And so he made me really sit down and think about the responsibility of creating this story and about what we were putting it, what we could be putting out in the world, and how that's going to affect every other Indian, you know, coming, you know, every other kid coming up into the world, and how they're going to see our thing as an example of maybe how they want to see themselves or not see themselves. So in the end, he bowed out. He's like, I want to be part of this. I think, again, I do whatever you want. I just don't think it's right for me and the kind of stuff I want to make. So he got out, Russell kind of came in and whatever. And years later, I'm finally working with Fox and we're making the pilot and, you know, we're casting and they go, why don't we get Hank Azaria to play the part of your dad. And I'm like, that's maybe not the best idea. And they go, why not? And everyone else, to be honest, is, you know, everyone else is like, yeah, just they're white. And they didn't really, you know, have the same
cultural competency.
they really as much weight in, you know, into this conversation as I did. So I'm like, this is a really big deal to me, guys. I don't want to just, you know, give this part to just anybody. And I don't think Apu, the guy who plays Apu, is the person to do this. And the way I put it was like, think about the advertising. Think about how this is going to be advertised to the world. Brand new show on Fox, Rancho Cucamonga, Indian family living in Cucamonga, starring Hank Azaria, right? Every Indian person is going to be like, what? Why? I mean, this is when, like, you got, like, Aziz Ansari coming, Mindy Kaling coming up. I mean, you have Indian comics out in the world. I'm like, why don't we go to the Indian comics? And Fox was like, well, we could, but I mean, Hank Azaria is really funny. I'm like, I know it's not that he's not funny. I just feel like, why wouldn't you just embrace the Indian world? Like, again, they're there. Like, you see, they're on like top shows, like they're on SNL and whatever. I mean, these are comics that we all see. So it's not like, you know, you're not getting the same, you know, like level of artistry out of them. You're not going to settle. And it came down to, and this is one of my favorite things that ever really happened, was Lorne Michaels and I met one-on-one in his office, and he literally said to me, "What can I do to help? I really want to help you make this the way you wanted it. I want you to be authentic and true to your, you know, your story and your dad and your family." I go, "I really want to get an Indian person to play the part of the Indian dad, especially, and I think Russell Peters might be good." And Lorne was like, "I'll back you up. Just whatever. I'll completely back you up." So we had to have a vote at Fox. Like, who were we going to get? And I obviously voted Russell Peters, and thankfully a few other people did too. But the what I think what really clinched it was that Lorne Michaels was like, "I'm with Ro. Let's get Russell. Let's get him to do it." And so this what when this all happened, and I, you know, Hari heard about this. He's like, "I want you to be in this documentary talking about your journey and, you know, the Apu thing." And it was kind of full circle because I started with him, and then here we are now talking about it. And it's because of him that I started to really think about the responsibility. And I even give lectures on this at UT, this like, you know, this authenticity responsibility that we all have to have culturally. And I got to say, like, you know, this is what kept me up for many nights during the process of making this pilot, was because it was so personal, and I felt like for the most part, it was, I was carrying the weight of the future of, you know, our culture on my shoulders, because no one else was going to get blamed for anything that wasn't culturally accurate. Like, no one's going to go to my writing partners who are, again, they're great, but they're not Indian. They're going to come
Right.
to gonna blame me if anything was like, you know, just if I was making over if I was overly making fun of anything, I think I would have gotten a lot of shit for it. And I think that's what I was afraid of. So I was trying to make sure. That's why when Russell got involved, I'm like, "Good, you can help me carry the weight." Because if you would, and there were many times when, like, I would, you know, we'd write a joke, and it'd be me and Russell trying to work it out, because I'm like, "You can write it any way you want, but how would an Indian person say it?" And that comes down to just me and Russell trying to figure it out, because you won't say it the way it's written, because that's not how an Indian person would say it. Which is, you know, my there were three writers and me, so you know, they're all great comedy guys, but all those nuances are not something that they could never write. And so it came down to Russell and I working it out, and which was beautiful, because then I felt like at least I had somebody on my side who could understand. And again, for he and I, it was like, how would our dad say it? That was it. How would our dad say it? Not what was the best version of the joke, but how would our dad say that line? And that became the most important part.
Man, I hope you can, revive it. I feel like the climate now is the best, is like even better, because nobody would ever say that today to do to give a white guy the role. Like, it's like taboo today, so.
Well, I love that. I think Azeri eventually, because of his daughters, from what I read, he eventually said, "I'm not, maybe I see it now." It took him a long time, but I think I remember reading about like how his daughters at school were being, you know, they were getting, they were hearing it from their friends about like, "Your dad, let's talk about your dad for a second, and about like what, how, you know, good or bad, what he's doing." And I think that was kind of cool that it took his children to make him maybe see, you know, maybe what, how he should be looking at it. Now, that said, I mean, I get actors. I you know, actors are actors. You can totally play the part of any different genre, you know, gender, whatever. I think that's fine. I have no problem. But I do think there is a certain amount of authenticity that you can't fake, with just getting any play the part. And I think that was what was important. But also I thought about, like, again, as an ad person, what's the big giant, you know, branding campaign they're going to put out in the world? Russell Peters in a new Indian comedy, as opposed to Hank Azaria in a new Indian comedy. Which one would you rather run towards if you're an Indian? Because if you get the Indian audience, which is your heart and soul of your audience, that's your main audience. I think that's going to just ripple outside of it, because those people, the joke is like, you know, you never go to an Indian restaurant recommended by white people, right? Runs that a restaurant. If an Indian restaurant, like, hey, you know what's real. I'm gonna go to that restaurant with any culture. So same thing with the show. I'm like, you rather have the Indian friends tell their non-Indian friends about the show than having your non-Indian friends tell the Indian friends about the show.
Yes. What three movies would you recommend to my audience and why? It doesn't have to be animation or TV shows.
Well, just because Miyazaki just won the Golden Globe, that's top of my list. The Boy and the Heron, is that what it's called, I think? Have you seen it yet?
No.
Oh, pretty damn good. And I mean, this is also kind of what I love about Austin. Austin is a very film town, so there's a lot of really cool independent theaters here and all that. So stuff like that, when it comes out, people like me run. I literally ran to Miyazaki comes out of retirement to make a new film. What? And I just ran to the theater. Probably the film that I think I watch repeatedly over and over and over again, I think is Nightmare Before Christmas. And Nightmare Before Christmas, not only because I'm a huge Tim Burton fan, even though Tim Burton didn't direct it, I think people should know that. But I just, I'm also a huge Oingo Boingo fan. So Oingo Boingo, the lead singer being Danny Elfman, who is the voice of the singing part of Jack Skellington in that film. I love the animation. I love the music. I obviously love everything when it comes to that whole, kind of surreal portal type world, which is nightmares, So that film, I can't watch that enough. And every time I watch it, I think I find new things to admire and respect about it. And as a filmmaker and as a stop motion person, I think I always like feel like I'm, trying to forever. It's like a constant source of inspiration.
Yeah,
And
I have a actually have a pocket watch, a Nightmare Before Christmas pocket watch that I think I got off of Etsy.
I'm jealous. I'm actually I'm such a huge fan of that. I mean, everything that I would say in my life that I started to really gravitate towards probably came out of specifically the band Oingo Boingo. In 1981, no, 83, I think we saw them at Cal Poly Pomona. It was like a 100-person concert, and my friends bought it for me for my surprise 16th birthday. And it was one of those experiences where they were still a small band. Again, a 100-person concert, and it's like, feel that Cal Poly Pomona. We'll always remember it as like, this is the day, like, everything changed. Like, I just, the music, the atmosphere, the vibe, my first real concert. And then later in life, like, Danny Elfman and the band in general is a part of so many things. I mean, they scored The Simpsons, Tim Burton movies, obviously Nightmare, Batman. And then, just all the music, and and anyway, that was like a big thing. So I think that's number two. And then the one thing that I think gets underrated a lot, which I think is still one of the best things made in the world of animation, is Jason and the Argonauts, which I think is a huge part of what stop motion, which is what I think spawn. I mean, stop motion is just special effects, right? But before there were special effects, there was only stop motion. And that's what I love about stop motion. It's like it's pure old school, but it's still alive. Like, it's still being used. I mean, all the even the modern films, even the Wes Anderson stuff, Fantastic Mr. Fox, Isle of Dogs, all that stuff. I mean, they're still utilizing. Even Pinocchio. I mean, I love modern stop motion, and it's as artful as those dolls have become, where you can make things move a little easier and better and faster. It's still old school animation techniques. I mean, there's, it's a lot of those films. I don't know why. I'm not really sure why, but you can tell. You can tell when it's not stop motion. It looks too polished. In fact, I even love how, like, even like, with Star Wars, in how Jon Favreau is bringing back, like, puppets, and and even when The Force Awakens came out, and they wanted to go old school and not have all the characters be CG and all the Star Wars stuff, and they wanted to bring back, more organic, just puppetry, and things that were on set, that were shot live. I don't know. I don't know what the science is behind it, but there's something about, I think, how we as humans react to it differently. And we find it far more, I don't know, friendly, lovable, kind,
Endearing.
endearing, as opposed to slick and a little bit more cold. So I do think that Yeah, but anyway, to answer your question, I think those three films are probably the three films that I think I would run out and see if anybody who's, I mean, if you're at all into not only animation, if you're into filmmaking, because all those require special effects in the sense of that is animation, stop motion, in a way that I don't think, if you look at it from the point of view special effects, yes, you can easily go and make special effects and CG. You can do it in, obviously in artificial intelligence with like Firefly and whatever else in today's world. Yes, but the craft of it is something that I think we love, and I think those films have it. And I also love, I just watched this documentary about the history of Industrial Light and Magic, and how Star Wars, how Industrial Light and Magic is really responsible for so many things like Photoshop, right? Photoshop came out of Lucas and the company trying to go into a more digital realm of how to create effects. And the I forget the guy's name, and his brother basically created what was going to become the original Adobe Photoshop, well, just Photoshop at the time. And they created a way to take an image and layer it and in many ways. It's just like what a multi-plane thing is for animation, how Disney would shoot like doubles of different levels of glass for a foreground, middle ground, background, or whatever. And that's what the planes were shooting down, and a down shooter of an animation camera to these different pieces of glass. So you only have to move this cell as opposed to all these three cells. And that's what Photoshop is, just in a more, as opposed to being vertical way, it was a horizontal, I guess, kind of looking through a looking glass, if you will. And I love that they go animation and whatever became the future of it. It all became, it's linked. And Industrial Light and Magic, so much of our culture of filmmaking comes out of that one company. And even now, the effects world that we have today was for that. For them and for all the things that I think came before them, which is, all the old school filmmakers who were just trying to figure out a way to move a tauntaun, across the landscape and empire. But it had to be stop motion because the only way you could move a character like that back then. But again, it was just special effects. It wasn't any specific version of special effects, which effects. Now we can give them all different descriptions because of the that we've seen. So I studying stop motion teaches me not only about the love of animation, but just about. So I still tell my school, like, go watch old stop mo go watch old Hollywood films, and study where we are now, because I'll start to appreciate what they had to do, what they had to deal with back then. It was a piece of glass and some clay and painted backdrop, and they've made these epic films. And even to myself, and to even like, you don't need a computer to make a lot of films. Like, you can literally do this in your garage. You just have to be smart about how you figure out a way to like shoot through a piece of glass to get the set you want, and not worry about like going in and compositing a whole lot of stuff on green screen if you don't want to, because that's how it was done. And the 50s, 60s, 70s, and it's in camera effects was all you had. So it's still something I still love watching.
And you're talking about the multi-part ILM documentary on Disney Plus? Or,
Yeah, it's like seven part series. Yeah,
It was really good.
it's great. It's like it's film school. I mean, I've watched it right now all the way through, and I've learned so much. I'm like, wow, I didn't know that's how they did Jurassic Park. I didn't know that's how they, did that scene in Poltergeist, and all. Yeah, amazing.
If someone was producing a documentary about you, what things would you want them to highlight about your life outside of your work in animation and advertising?
Wow, good question. It's I okay. I've been teaching now for 4.5 years, right? I've never taught before, never even, I don't know. I just it never was on my list of things I wanted to do in my life, to be honest. I love talking about creativity, but it's become such a great It's kind of a two-way street. I think talking about creativity all day with students makes me a better creative, because what you do when you're teaching creativity is you have to basically break down process in a way you've never had to do it before. Because if you're just doing it for yourself, you don't think about how you think, right? You don't like sit there and be like, well, when I do this thing, this is how my brain is telling my hand how to move a certain way. You just do it, because it's like at some point just instinctive. And, you know, but when you talk about creativity with students all day, it makes you so much more aware of your own creativity, right? So I think now what I would say is I'd be interesting to see what I say to students, and then what do I do when I come home? Like when I come back to my studio, how do I actually implement it? I think I'm walking the walk and not just talking. But I'd be cool to see somebody actually like hold me up to see, to be responsible for my words. But I've never been more aware of myself, of like, you know, am I doing what I'm saying? Like, right. I tell students, you know, you've got to be, I was looking at the example of Johnny Depp when he got the part to be Jack Sparrow in Pirates of the Caribbean, right? So his insight, he's like, you know what? Pirates are probably like rock stars back in their day. So I'm going to portray Jack as Keith Richards, and I'm going to be a Keith Richards version of a rock star as a pirate. So that's a really smart set of math, like rock star Richards, and I'm going to play him in the movie. So I like the idea of him being like a method actor kind of approach to it. And I think that's how I think now more and more about everything I do. Like, how am I going to be, like, if I'm going to do a painting that's like this, which is like, I don't know what this is. This is just that's like drugs, basically. So I'm not going to do drugs while I do it, because I don't think I can concentrate. I have no problem with drugs. I just don't want to do it while I do it. But I want to get that mentality. So what do I do? So I put on, I think, like a Pink Floyd-like soundtrack in the background. And, you know, I probably just got as many colors that I thought were going to be like hyper colors. And I opened those jars of paint and probably lit incense or something in the room. You kind of get my mind into that space. And then I painted, you know what I mean? So in a way, like, I'm trying to like kind of put myself in the situation of the mindset of that place. And if I'm doing much more exacting, I might put in like, you know, Tibetan flute music in the background or something to kind of get me into a calm state. So I think that's something I constantly do. If I'm writing, you know, like if I'm writing something that's like really fun and lively and action oriented, I might go sit in a bar and go sit in the corner of the bar and write, because I've got like chatter and noise and atmosphere and, you know, people, and it kind of, the energy of that might help me create that thing. So, and then, you know, again, if I'm writing something, I might actually, you know, be very much like, you know, using the world around me to help write that. Like, I was writing on the plane, for example, on the way back from India, and I purposely was playing Indian movies on my TV on the plane while I'm writing. Wanted to use that as like constant, like kind of just almost like you know, just like a reminder of what the path is of what I'm trying to create. But yeah, I think I'm trying to live up to what I say, and, you know, mm-hmm. like use like the mindset, like be a method actor in everything I create, whether it's music or art or animation or whatever. You know, try to put on the outfit of the part that I want to, you know, live up to, if you will. And constantly just, you know, just keep what I call the perpetual pivot is what I use in my class. I just think like that's, you never realize how many things you can do by just like I never would have gotten into, I don't think I would have gotten into animation as much if I didn't draw. One of the things that my writing partner and I did, we made a series of children's books, right? So these are one of our books, and mm-hmm. it has like tons of drawings in it, and the drawings became like a nice gateway for me to create like a scene, like a single, a drawing that sums up like a whole scene. And the more we did, 7 books, and you know, by the time we were done, that's probably about 700 drawings, about, you know, maybe shy of 100 per book. But you worked out how to condense a scene into one. So if you think about like what a great storyboard is for a film, you know, for when you're doing anything, you've got to be able to condense a moment into a frame. And then ideally, because you've got so much like, you know, storytelling and eye candy impacted in that one frame, that can help you when you're shooting it, for especially for animation, because you could build this really giant world, but you're focusing on this one character, but you've able to create a landscape that it just becomes atmosphere, and you know, kind of you're soaking it in, even though you're not even noticing every little detail. So I think by writing stories and then drawing stories, and then now animating stories, each one was a pivot into the next thing. And I got better at this and got better at this, hopefully got better at this. And then that ended up making my paintings even better, because now I started to really start to build, in a way, landscapes. And now I'm like, let me go the other way and take all that and condense it now into a painting. And how do I tell a lot in one, you know, piece of canvas that I can still condense so many layers of storytelling? You may never know in a painting what I may be trying to say, because it's a painting, but you can look at it and be like, hopefully there's something going on. There's some energy here. I'm not really sure exactly. It's not as logical as like, say, maybe like a piece of comedy, but you can feel something going on in this world. There's, it's saying something, you know, but hopefully like good art, it may not be as understood on a logical level. You can feel it, but you may not understand it. But I think that's what I think is constantly happening. You're taking what you did last, adding something new to it, and you're pivoting one more degree. And then you're adding to it and adding something new and going another. So I like this perpetual pivot kind of mentality of like, I think how, so I think, you know, to go back to your question, I think that'll be something interesting, is how would you build like the landscape of like, this led to this, led to this, led to this. Mm-hmm. But one, it makes sense if you go back one step. If you go back 2 years, you know, or the last project I did, you're like, oh, I get why animation came out of the books. I get how books came out of like, you know, these early versions of your comics. You know, and then eventually how the record store idea came out because of the film you did, that's stop motion, the animated short film about the album covers, that led to this, and then that led to this. And it's just like this constant, you know, pivot. And I think that's something that I don't think I really think about as much, because you're just living your life and you're just like making whatever you're working on next.
Yeah.
I pause and look backwards and be like, oh yeah, I was there like 2 years ago, and now I'm here. I didn't, you know, you don't think about it because you're just walking forward and not trying to, you know, look back in the rear view mirror too much.
Yeah.
But it does make sense whenever I do pause, and times like this when I do have to kind of like think about how the hell did I get here.
So how can people follow you or find you?
The two easiest ways are Instagram, which I love, because you can be anywhere in the world and this comes up, which I think is great. Like, I was literally in Sydney, I was in India, and the number one thing, you meet the most random people on the street, they'll be like, oh, do this much. I'm like, go on Instagram. Oh my God, so fast. And instantly you're friends. The two Instagrams, one is Rohit, R-O-H-I-T, Rohit 913, which is my birthday, September 13th. And my second one is Rohit Records. So Rohit, R-O-H-I-T Records. And that's my other Instagram. And one is obviously more focused on the records art show. And the other one is just everything. It's like everything I do, my stop motion, my paintings. It's kind of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really want to go and see stuff, you can go to my website, which is just rohitashrao.com, which is just rohitashrao.squares. Rohitashrao.com will find it. And then I have one for just my main art, which is rohitashraopaintsontrash.com, because started painting was one of the things that like you learn very quickly in your advertising world, is that I think people like people to stay in boxes. Like people want you to stay a writer. If you're an art director in advertising, people want you to stay an art director in advertising. So when I was saying, I'm going to go be a director, I'm going to be a painter, they're like, maybe just be an art director, just stay kind of in your lane. And I'm like, yeah, but I really want to do the art thing. They're like, you're not a fine artist, man. Like you write funny ads for, you know, Little Caesars and, you know, commercials that are, they're funny, but that's not an art. It's not fine art. So I had to, in a way, prove to myself that I could do it, but I didn't want to just jump and buy, like, you know, $100 canvases to paint on. So I started painting on trash. So I would walk around New York City and I pick up random pieces of, like, you know, fast food cups and, you know, crushed tin cans, and I'd paint on it. And this is when Tumblr was a thing. And my Tumblr page was called Art for Beer. And I would just sell my art for a beer, because it was like, well, for a lot, these are all my, just asking for a beer, just nothing big, just no commitment. Just give me a beer and I'll give you a piece of trash art. And
didn't you say your parents would mail you trash?
Well, my parents were for the first ones who started to get me okay with it, because I would go in the garage and I would just find random pieces of trash, like in the garbage or pieces of wood that my dad abandoned that, you know, was building a shelf or something. So for them, it was fine because it was household paint. It was garbage. It cost them no money. They didn't buy art supplies. They didn't buy any, you know, canvases. It was just like, whatever you have in the garage, go make something out of that. And they did. So eventually, everybody in my circle started to leave me trash in front of my door. Like in my studio, especially when I was in Vancouver, would just come to my studio and there'd be like, you know, cigarette boxes and like, you know, crushed cans. And I'm like, what have I done? But worst part or the best part, I would go to bars in LA, New York, and I would bring like a box of trash art to the bar. And I'm sitting at the bar and laying it out on the bar. And the bartender's like, you can't lie all this trash here, man. What are you doing? We're trying to serve drinks. And I'm like, well, my friends are going to come and they're going to buy me a beer and they're going to take one of the pieces of trash. They're going to buy me a beer. He's like, what? And I go, well, that's how this works. It's art for beer. And, you know, a couple of times it got to the point where I would get seven beers, you know, got seven people to buy it. And the bartender's like, I can't give you seven beers. I mean, that's like, how do you give me money? Like, and so I had to go to them. I'm like, can you give me money instead? Cause I can't, he's right. You can't give me seven beers tonight. It's not going to work. So he would buy me three beers and give me like, you know, $100. And I'm like, so that's how it started. And then eventually, mm-hmm. Well, I'll sell this for $50 or $100. And then the prices started going up. I started painting on more and more bigger. Like even that painting it's on a thrift store canvas that I bought at the thrift store. It's just, you know, a $10 canvas that was, you know, I painted over. Or album covers, which I'm just, you know, I buy dollar albums and I just put my own art over it. So I'm still in that mentality of painting on found objects or things that I just get. I don't really buy high end. Every now and again I will, but not really. I have this recycling mentality. And I'm in an art compound in Austin, and there's at least two big dumpsters here, and artists throw away the greatest shit. Like I find canvases that are like big that somebody painted on, they hated it and they threw it away, and I'll take it. So I'm still dumpster diving and getting stuff out. You can't help it. It's just lying there. I mean, it's a big giant piece of canvas. I mean, why not?
Right.
But even though I think my definition of trash has changed, but I still do paint on trash.
Yeah. Well, I would like to thank you for coming on my platform and allowing me to highlight you. I really appreciate it.
I love that you wanted to talk to me. Thank you so much for hearing me out.
And to everyone out there, I want you to like, so I know it's real. Comment and tell me how you feel. Subscribe to Citadel and sign up for post notifications to show your zeal. And I'll see you in the next video. Peace.
Awesome.